on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
You know, we're all on the spaceship planet Earth together. There's not one person that can steer this thing. Right. That's totally the height of stupidity. Yeah. And for Wilson, he's known as the conspiracy theory guy. But for him, the ultimate conspiracy is the conspiracy of stupidity.
Yeah.
And looking around right now, we are headlong involved in someone else's conspiracy of stupidity. Yeah. Right. And we're trying to pump the brakes. And I really like that quote from Discordianism. I don't know if Wilson wrote it or if Greg Hill, you know, put words to it, but I think they call it the Shriya Saradasti or something like that. And somewhat influenced by Bertrand Russell and Buddhism. And it's the quote that, like, all affirmations are true in some sense, false in some sense, meaningless in some sense. And then Wilson would add true and false in some sense, true, false, and meaningless in some sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, which, yeah, emphasizes perspective, at least within his philosophy.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living Earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, author Gabriel Kennedy returns to continue our discussion of his book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. We discuss Wilson's diverse interests, including Buddhism, meditation, and the influence of thinkers like Alan Watts and Aleister Crowley, Wilson's thoughts on enlightenment, trance states, and the intersection of science and spirituality, and how he synthesized different philosophies in his lifelong quest for wisdom and compassion. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Gabriel Propanon Kennedy is a multimedia artist concentrating on the written word, visual art, and music. His work has appeared in boingboing.net, mondo2000.com, bonustracks.com, and on his own websites, chapelperilous.us and propanon.com. He first interviewed Robert Anton Wilson in 2003 and was an original member of Wilson's online learning website, the Maybe Logic Academy. He has joined me before to talk about his book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, and he is back on the program today to dig a little bit deeper into Robert Anton Wilson. Gabriel, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thanks for having me on again, Nick. Great to see you, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And looking forward to it. There's a lot to cover with Robert Anton Wilson. So I'm glad that we decided to pursue this a little bit in more depth. And I think that what we're going to talk about is Wilson and Buddhism. And you're definitely going to know a lot more about it than I am. I've read several of his books, but it's been a while. I have some of his audio recordings, and I know that he was talking about Buddhism on one, and I could not find it. What I did in preparation was I was listening to Religion for the Hell of It, where he's really attacking in many ways, or criticizing, maybe is a better way of saying it, some of the religious traditions. But he doesn't have too many harsh words for Buddhism, it seems. So what exactly was Bob's interest in Buddhism?
Yeah, that's a great question. Wilson was a lifelong sort of practitioner of you know, meditation, if you will. And I guess for him, the story begins in around 1957. Wilson, as I mentioned the last time, was born in 1932 in the South Shores of Brooklyn, what he called an Irish Catholic ghetto. You know, so there weren't many Buddhists in that neighborhood. But he's sort of part of this generation that of Americans that, you know, discover Buddhism, right? And then really explore it throughout the rest of his life. And for him, he had a great introduction and a great mentor and teacher in the form of Alan Watts. The origin story, I guess, might begin there. Alan Watts, around 1957, released his book, The Way of Zen. And young Wilson, who was already studying general semantics, which focuses, among many things, but one important focus is to attain what they call the silent level experience of living, which is just getting in touch with yourself with no words, if you will, or, you know, just attaining pure, you know, understanding your perception, right? Mm-hmm. And so Wilson was sort of prepared for, you know, Buddhist logic, if you will, and the sort of interior nature of, you know, Buddhist awareness to draw attention and mindfulness on your own perception and then your own habit of projection as well, you know. So, and Wilson read Watts's book, and somewhere along the line, he became friends with Alan Watts. He described Alan Watts in books like Cosmic Trigger Volume 1 as a mentor. Watts, of course, died in 1973. So there was difficult to find, say, correspondence between the two or anything like that, though it might still be out there. So Wilson learns about many things in Watts's book, you know, one of which is, you know, the book, as I said, is called The Way of Zen. But he learns about this, a couple of different types of Buddhism that Watts speaks about, like Abba Buddhism, right? And the Amitabha Buddha was, you know, one of the main Buddhas in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. And of course, in Buddhism, there's three main branches. You know, there's Mahayana, Theravada, and Hinayana. And I guess Mahayana is sort of the most, I don't even want to say if it's the most practiced or not, but it seems like
it is. It is. It's the most popular form of Buddhism. And it has, like, also similar to Protestant Christianity, there are all these different sort of denominations within Mahayana Buddhism.
Yeah, right on. Yeah. So Wilson was, you know, I sort of this, well, I don't want to place a chronological generational thing, but
right.
Maybe he's second generation of Buddhism in America, between first and second. I say that because Wilson, who was living in New York City, he found shortly after reading Watts's book, this place called the New York Buddhist Church, which is a kind of like an establishment there in New York City now, like, because it's been there for so long. It was created in 1938. Hmm. And it was sort of like an offshoot of a temple that was already established in Kyoto, Japan. And the focus of the New York Buddhist Church is Shinran or Shin Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And so founded by Shinran Shonin, the founder, as I said, in around the 13th century, I believe.
Yeah.
And it's cool because there you could see it on their website. They have a life-size statue of Shinran sort of at the kind of entryway of the, you know, walking towards the entrance of the church. And that was the New York Buddhist Church. That was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, sort of established, you know, Buddhist temple in America. And a bit of a tangent, but I know Alan Watts was somewhat involved in that. I think he married the daughter of the woman who, like, founded it or something like that. Mm. That was like maybe his first marriage or something. Mm. I'm not an expert at Watts, but I do know that Watts, I believe, married a woman who was a secretary at the General Semantic Society that Wilson was going to, a woman named Jane Heyburn, I believe. Mm. And she changed her name when she married Alan. And Wilson mentions her in Cosmic Trigger Volume 1. But I mention all that because it's an interesting little network, because it's actually Jane who's the one that sets up Bob and Arlen. Jane is the one that kind of connects them, because Arlen is also a member of the New York General Semantic Society. And in 1958, that's when Bob and Arlen first meet through, as I said, Jane suggests that Bob give a practice lecture at Arlen's apartment in the Upper West Side, New York City, because he was giving his first ever, like, professional lecture, if you will, for the New York General Semantic Society around that time. So, that's a very interesting thing how, you know, Watts and his, you know, kind of network play in with Bob and then Arlen at that early time. And Bob and Arlen meet, they hit it off, and they marry a year later. In 1959, and they actually marry at the New York Buddhist Church.
Okay.
And it's a very, I write about it in my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, because it's sort of like Wilson wrote about their marriage vows, and, you know, they're married by a person named Reverend Yoshimaki. And, you know, they did the vows. And do you, Robert and Arlen, place your trust in the Buddha? Yes. Do you, Robert and Arlen, place your trust in the Dharma? Yes, they said. And do you, Arlen, Robert and Arlen, place your trust in the Sangha? And there was a moment of pause because at the time they weren't really sure what that meant. But of course, Sangha means like sort of like a sacred community where everyone there is striving to attain, you know, their Buddhahood, if you will, you know, striving for the best that they could be. And so they looked at each other, then looked at the reverend, then looked at each other again and said, yes, 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 the Sangha, yes. But afterwards, they're standing on the corner, you know, by the park. And Arlen turns to Bob and says, what the hell is a Sangha? Right. And little did they know that they would create a Sangha, right? And that for the rest of their lives, they would collect friends that were, you know, really a core group of compassionate, you know, among decades, compassionate, fun, and nice people who really, when it came to, you know, fast forwarding to when both Arlen and Bob pass away, they were, you know, lucky enough to have these really nice people around them who understood like the sacredness of this process of dying and to, you know, to be there. And, you know, someone like Val Corral, for instance, you know, she's done a lot of work in that area and she was there for Bob and Arlen. But, you know, going back to the late 50s, if you will, it was probably, I'm not sure where Wilson came across the notion of Taoism, but whether it was through Alan Watts or other writers, but of course he was very aware of it. And his sort of first big article is published in 1959, and it's about James Joyce and the Tao. It's about, you know, Taoist elements that Wilson found in reading Finnegan's Wake. And I write about that in my book. I mean, it's an extremely profound article, you know, written by a young man at that time. He's still in his 20s, around 27 years old. Yeah, he's 27 years old. And the depth of insight into both Finnegan's Wake and Taoism is pretty astounding at that time. And so much, you know, he knows this stuff so well that it just so happens also around the time of publishing this article, he's at a party, a little mixer in New York City. And who does he come upon but the great comparative religion expert, Joseph Campbell, who's also a huge fan of James Joyce and Taoism and whatnot. And so he finds himself in a conversation with Joseph Campbell. So that was very interesting timing. He was very sharp then with his you know, comparative religion expertise at that moment. So, yeah, and Campbell, you know, I'm sure recognized, like, you know, a talented young mind. Wilson continues along.
I was just going to say that I think Campbell's first book was A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, I didn't know it was his first book. Wow.
I think so. I could be wrong on that, but I think it was. I think it preceded Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert in Campbell, so that very well could be true. Yeah. He was a huge fan of James Joyce. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole notion of the hero's journey and the idea of the monomyth, it comes from Joyce.
Right.
It comes from maybe Finnegan's Wake. So says Robert Anton Wilson. So Bob and Arlen are, you know, Bob was raised, as I said, Irish Catholic, but he quickly became an atheist at the age of 13. Right. So this notion of Buddha, no self, and sort of a Taoist process, an interacting processes, which he sort of found translated to the Tao Te Ching, I suppose, right? This made way more sense than God in the sky, you know, and that was the premise of his other huge article from 1959 called The Semantics of God, which was published in The Realist magazine, Paul Krasner's pioneering counterculture magazine. And that really started his career off with a bang. This article about Joyce and Taoism, and an article basically what I would call about, negative theology, really, with sort of like a Buddhist Taoist tinge to it. You know, that article, you know, Bob asks, does God have a penis, right? Because, you know, we're anthropomorphizing this process. And in doing so, we greatly reduce the magnificence of whatever this thing is, you know? And he found that Buddhism sort of and Taoism approached this sort of, you know, the ability to kind of really take that in, the grandiosity of that, experience. I don't know how aware he was. He probably was, but I don't know how aware he was of negative theology. And I'm sure he was, though, because it's been around for so long.
Yeah.
But that idea of negative theology, that like God is too big to even, once we speak about it, it's like devaluing God. And that's where you fall into idolatry. And idolatry is a, you know, a sin in the sense that you're just being really stupid. You know, like God is so much bigger than anything we could say, any explanation we could give. You know, it's pointless to even talk about it sometimes. And I think Wilson really, that sort of syncopates with his personality. And I should say, too, that like there could be this sort of cultural heritage that he picks up from the Irish, because, I mean, one of the most famous negative theologists, if you will, was Scotus, John Scotus Origina. Right. John the Irish of Ireland, as that name translates to. But, you know, I mean, he's a philosophical heavyweight, and he was really maintaining this idea of, you know, negative theology for a very long time. And the Irish kind of have this sort of an aspect to them as well. That's like, just don't even talk about it. It just is what it is, you know. And so not all, but it's a current within the culture, I'd say. And but continuing on, Wilson is just, the momentum is moving. His mind is like moving at like 1,000 miles an hour, because of course Buddhism is just one sort of strand in this huge lattice, the multi-ordinal fucking thing that he's building, philosophy that he's building in his mind. You know, he moves to Yellow Springs, Ohio, in around 1962-63. He gets involved with this thing called the sort of political school called the School of Living, which stresses sort of self-reliance and, you know, anarchism, basically. And it's the first time he does peyote and any psychedelics. He orders it from like a back of a magazine. He gets like a box of peyote because it's legal at that time, and it lasts for like over a year. He's doing peyote all the time, like in his sort of rural, beautiful, it was the Glen Helen Park Reserve in right there in Yellow Springs, Ohio. It's still there. It's just a little nature reserve right in this town that's centered around Antioch College. It's a beautiful little spot. And but also when during that time, there's a community center called the Vale, and someone from there actually hosts or brings in this Zen monk called Yasutani Roshi. And Yasutani Roshi, I guess, is famous, you know, for being one of the first Zen practitioners from the East to really bring the message to the West. And he taught Zen koan to, I don't know if taught is the word, but he gave Zen koans to the practitioners. And I think this is where Wilson really got a love for the Zen koan. Of course, he's a mind that like is, you know, interested in paradox to begin with, right? And Zen koans are, the focus is to cause a paradox, a linguistic paradox in your mind that you just escape like words and enter a state of enlightenment, if you will. Or the Zen koan priest will hit you in the head with a stick.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, you know, and in Yellow Springs, there was a tradition of Quakerism and Unitarians, mm-hmm. sort of very open sort of spiritual environment. And as I said, Roshi visited with an assistant, and he taught the students about Kensho. And this is the belief that everything is a Buddha nature. So, and then he also taught them all about Zazen meditation, which of course is like seated meditation and focused on breathing and whatnot. And, you know, and this is something that really stuck with Bob, because he wrote about this for the rest of his career. This one question that Roshi brought up during a Zazen lecture. Wilson asked Roshi, "What's enlightenment?" And, you know, Roshi replied, "Well, you do it every night when you're asleep. Now, all you must do is do it when you are awake." So, of course, he's going to get a reply like that. What the heck does that mean? You know, and I'm not going to explain it. I'm not going to explain it. Let's let the viewers work that out.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of my ongoing questions is, what exactly do we mean by enlightenment anyway? And I have a distrust, I have to say, of anyone who claims to be enlightened. I constantly using the same quote, but something that Thoreau wrote in Walden, which was, I have never met a man who is quite awake. If I had, how could I look him in the face?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
truth.
Yeah.
You know, and staying humble towards this notion of enlightenment.
Yeah.
At the time, too, culturally within America and I guess the West, if you will, that was sort of maybe a new term, enlightenment, and the kind of cachet, that kind of cultural cachet, I think lasted through the 90s into the 2000s. But I don't think you hear too many people talking about enlightenment much these days.
Oh, no, I see people all the time. I get a lot of blurbs from various publishers and publicists, and sometimes they'll, you know, say, hey, how about this person? Would you like to have them on your podcast? And there are many times where these people will say that they are enlightened. And I'm like, no, you know, as soon as you say you're enlightened, no, I'm not talking to you. That's just self-delusion. No, but it seems like I kind of want to step back here for a moment and give you a moment to kind of catch your breath, because you covered a lot. And there are a few things I would like to talk about in regards to what you've said, but I kind of want to go back to Alan Watts just for a moment. So Wilson met him in the 50s, in 57. Is that right?
Well,
is that what you said?
It would be around the late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and when did Wilson and his family move to Berkeley?
To Berkeley, 1974.
Okay. All right. So that would have been much later. Yeah. I was just kind of curious. I was like connecting some dots that I didn't know whether or not they could be connected. So I know that in the 50s, largely it was the beat writers, you know, Ginsberg and Kerouac and Burroughs, especially Kerouac and Ginsberg, who had an interest in Buddhism. And there was an early move. There was an original interest in Buddhism a little bit earlier than that, but it was really sort of I think what they refer to as like a suitcase religion, where it was immigrants bringing it to the nation with them. Mm-hmm. But then there was and I don't remember what year this was, probably around World War II, where the immigration was put, there was an end put to immigrants from Asia. And then that was lessened, I think, in like 1962, I want to say. And that's when you started getting more Buddhist teachers coming over, like D.T. Suzuki, for example. He was one of the famous ones as well. But what I was trying to piece together was some of the dating and the time, because I know that Alan Watts had a radio program on the Pacific Station in Berkeley. And then he ended up at everyone is going to beat me up on this because I should know this, but what became the California Institute of Integral Studies originally was, I think it was first like the American Institute of Asian Studies, and then it became the California Institute of Asian Studies. And I also know that they had a lot of classes and they weren't accredited for a long time, and Alan Watts taught there. So I was kind of thinking that maybe that would be one way that he and Bob Wilson may have rubbed shoulders, as it were. But it sounds like, I mean, it could have happened still in the 70s when he did live in Berkeley.
Yeah, I mean, well, Wilson talks about three huge influences that Watts had on him. You know, he introduced him to Zen, like I said, in around 57, or, you know, around that time. He introduced him to Timothy Leary's work. He told Bob over lunch one day in around 1960, late 63, early 64, about this guy, Tim Leary. And then Bob then interviews Leary for The Realist magazine, the article Leary's Psychological H-Bomb. And then Leary and Bob become, you know, friends after that. And then Watts introduces Bob to Aleister Crowley and Israel Regardie in over a lunch, I think, you know, somewhere at the Playboy Club, I think, in 1970.
Right.
So, I mean, Watts is a major, you know, impact and influence on Bob. But again, Watts died, I believe, in around 1973.
Yeah.
And Bob went off the map when he quit Playboy in 71. That started his, you know, Chapel Perilous years, if you will.
Right.
And a major part of that was the, you know, the descent, the economic descent and geographical uncertainty and just moving around so much, probably lost contact with Alan. And then there's not much mention of Alan Watts in some way, although his after that, but his right. influence is pretty major.
Sure. Yeah, I can see it. And I was just curious because I'm a graduate of the California Institute of Integral Studies. And so I know a little bit of the history, even if I'm getting the names wrong. So I thought it would be interesting if there was a Robert Anton Wilson connection there somehow, other than the friendship with Watts. I did grow up very close to Yellow Springs, though.
Wow.
And that had been when I was in high school. That's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to go to Antioch. Still kind of regret not doing so, but yeah.
Beautiful place.
I had a chance
to see it recently. Yeah. Drove through the town, mm-hmm. saw the Glen Helen Nature Preserve, mm-hmm. although it was too late to go inside. Really beautiful place, man.
Yeah. It was this weird little oasis in Ohio, because it's just outside of Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton's kind of a failed city at this point, as far as I know. But yeah, my aunt would take me there every now and then, and she absolutely loved it. And even when she and my uncle ended up leaving the state, they moved to Indiana. Occasionally, they would still make a pilgrimage to Yellow Springs because it is a unique little city. It still is, as far as I know. I haven't been there for a very long time, but
I like the vibe there. Did you get a chance? Did you ever go into the Glen Helen Nature Preserve? Did you ever walk around there?
Probably when I was when I was a lot younger.
That's
where that my aunt. Yeah. yeah. There, and probably there was I always want to call it like a pub, but that's. It's like a traditional pub. I remember going in there several times as well. So I would have been there probably as a kid at some point while he was living there. But, you know, I would have been like six.
Right on.
You know, wouldn't have known anything about Robert Anton Wilson, I think. If I have my years right, I don't know.
Were you born in the 50s?
No.
Okay.
No.
So well, he was there. The early 60s he was there.
Okay, yeah, so never mind. This was
okay. I was like, man, you look young, Nick.
Yeah. Well, I don't look my age. That's one thing. Fair but I did warn you that my brain's a little bit fuzzy today. So
no worries.
Yeah, it's allergy season. The trees are in bloom, and that gets me every year. So one of the things that since you mentioned one of the other influences that Watts introduced Wilson to, which was Aleister Crowley. And that was something that when I was thinking through all of this, because I know that, you know, yoga and Buddhism are not the same thing. Although I always, whenever I teach, I make the point that Buddhism really kind of emerges out of the yoga philosophy in ancient India. So there are some very real parallels, but where I'm trying to get to here is Wilson's practice of yoga, because that was, and this is something that I want to know more about. And if I had any sense about myself when I was looking for a dissertation topic, this is probably what I would have done it on. But I know, like in Crowley's book 4, the first chapter is all about yoga.
Yeah.
So what can you say about Wilson and his readings and understanding of maybe yoga/Buddhism and sort of the magic and philosophy of Crowley? Because I know when we spoke the last time, if I remember correctly, Wilson's work was kind of influential for chaos magic, which is different than Crowley. But I don't know if what he was doing, how rooted it was in the yoga that Crowley was doing. But anyway, that's kind of a meandering question for you.
Yeah, for sure. No, completely irrelevant. Yes. So Crowley was known for, I guess, two things there, you know, according to Wilson, you know, bringing in the scientific method into the Western esoteric tradition, sort of sharpening the rituals with, you know, the scientific method, understanding that, how essential it was to keep a magical diary and to really observe changes, whatever. And then another thing was this fusion of magic and yoga. And I'm not sure if the Golden Dawn did this sort of stuff. But of course, Crowley, you know, received yoga lessons, like, I don't know if it was when he was in Ceylon or something like that. So that's what makes his lessons so interesting, is that he's going to these sources and learning these methods, and then he's integrating it into you know, what he learned from the Golden Dawn and whatnot. And, you know, I think he wrote a book called Yoga for Yahoos or something.
Yeah.
Wilson's introduction and probably main practice of yoga is through this sort of Thelemic Crowleyan lens. And I mean, you know, there's been books, many people have commented on this, and where it's gone is when you look at magic stuff, it's very much like yoga to begin with. And it's also like, you know, Tantra, Vajrayana Buddhism. You know, Vajrayana Buddhism is about, it's this sort of, it's Tantra, right? It's Buddhist Tantra, but it's all about thought forms and evoking these entities that, you know, exist within the tradition, and you're literally like evoking them to work with them. So that's magic, magic, you know, the basics of magic, from my understanding, I'm far from an expert. You know, you learn the basic things, like first the lesser banishing ritual, which is just consecrating the space. But then you learn to, you know, evoke and invoke, right? Those are major, like, and the invocation is all part of your practice to attaining knowledge and conversation with your holy guardian angel. You know, Crowley, this was his, according to Wilson, this was his main focus of all his work. This was his life's mission. The great beast, 666, was to turn everyone on to their holy guardian angels, right? Yeah. And that's not Satan. No, that's right. Your angel. You know what I mean? And like, so that's so funny. I just think Crowley's so funny for that.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting to tie in another really great thinker from that era, John C. Lilly, a quote that he wrote or said that really always stayed with me was when he said, "Science is the yoga of the West and yoga is the science of the East." So here you are again, sort of like Crowley, you know, there's this, you know, integration of the scientific method with yoga in John C. Lilly. He didn't really practice magic, but then here comes Bob, you know, tying all these things together. And yeah, it's a really wonderful sort of trifecta, you know, study more science, study more yoga, and study some magic and see what happens. So the notion of, I guess, Maya, observing, you know, staying centered while everything sort of plays out, that of course comes from Buddhism, and it is integrated later into yoga, and those two are really beautiful how they work together. Wilson had a huge experience using weed and observing Maya in 1968. He smoked weed in his earlier days, like in 1955. He first smoked weed in the bathroom of the Village Vanguard, watching the Modern Jazz Quartet, great jazz band, play. But he couldn't score weed on the regular. It wasn't like today. Right. But in 1968, that's the time. And he starts smoking weed on the regular starting then, I think. And that's when he observes this notion of Maya, which is essentially projection, right? I should note that during that time, and that's when he's working at Playboy, Wilson was already maintaining a Buddhist practice as well. He moved around on the spectrum of Buddhist practices. So in 1966, and during that rest of the era in Chicago, Bob practiced the thing called Nichiren Buddhism, right? Which is a branch of Mahayana Buddhism. And it was started by a fella named Nichiren, who is a Japanese Buddhist monk from the 13th century as well. And it also focuses this, for Bob, the Buddhism that he was kind of into was like this notion of Pure Land Buddhism, where like Amitabha, like the Buddha of like compassion and joy, is that's his guy, right? Yeah. And all these things that he moves around in, it all kind of focuses on, again, this notion of the Pure Land or the Western lands. And in that tradition, it's in the Pure Land where you go to achieve like reincarnation into like a joyful spirit or something. And William S. Burroughs ends up writing a book called The Western Lands in 1987, which kind of like picks up on the strain, because Burroughs is in this milieu as well. Right. He's sort of into these sort of types of Buddhism. But I think Bob does a great, you know, his exploration of it is really great. What's interesting about Nichiren Buddhism is they have a chant. And so it's not so much a meditation. When you sit in you chant, and the belief is that it's this chant that will bring you to, you know, the Western lands and the state of enlightenment. And so Christina, Bob's daughter, remembers, you know, back in the Chicago days when Bob was making money as a writer for Playboy, they were lamping. So he had the nice wraparound leather couch, right? And yeah, she would see him with his beads chanting, you know, on the couch, like saying like, Nam Myo Renge Kyo, Nam Myo Renge Kyo, Man Ryo, over and over and over again. And of course, she got curious about this stuff. She's like, what's this guy doing? Yeah. And, you know, and Bob really, he practiced these things. It wasn't just, again, like some armchair philosopher. Like, he loved experimenting. And this is what Crowley offered as well, like, you know, physical experiments. And he was always into this sort of thing. And Crowley offers this other sort of practice that Bob got a kick out of. I don't know if he ever did it in life himself, but Bob calls it Crowley's Zen counter games. And essentially it was Crowley loved taking on aliases and just pretending to be someone else, like when checking into hotels, or this is stuff that rich people can do, right? Yeah, you just pretend you're someone else going here and there. But, you know, Crowley wasn't just doing it as a goof, I suppose, or at least Wilson believed so. He was really doing it to see what it was like to live through, to walk in another man's shoes. Right. And to gain this perspective, this wider, which I think brings sort of compassion, right? And so, yeah, Bob loved that stuff. Arlen took on aliases kind of as a goof when she would call in right-wing talk radio shows and pretend to be someone else. But Bob was maybe too well-known to do that. So, yeah, by the time he discovers like Crowley and magic and yoga, and it's, again, it's yoga that's informed by Crowley. He's not Bob's. Again, this isn't, there isn't Bikram yoga. There isn't Vinyasa yoga. People don't even know about yoga really, right, at that time in the West. But Bob sort of integrates all of this into, again, a foundation that was laid through general semantics, which is similar, what he called an isomorphism, like things that are, you know, similar in structure, but not completely matching. That's general semantics and Buddhism and magic and yoga. These things are not all the same thing. There's some distinct differences. But for him, he thought there was so much value in really getting your stripes and collecting your belts, white, blue, yellow, brown, orange, you know, to your black belt. And all of these things is possible because it all brings you closer to knowledge itself, you know, and that's what this all comes down to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems to me that, you know, maybe that was his ultimate goal, is not necessarily enlightenment, but just wisdom.
I'd say so. Yeah. I mean, Bob's notion of enlightenment, enlightenment. Well, I mean, there's this phrase, and it's actually, he used it a lot. Do I have it? It was from Dogen, the Dogen phrase. And he uses this in a Cosmic Trigger. And yeah, and it's before one studies Zen, mountains are mountains and waters are waters. After a glimpse into the truth of Zen, mountains are no longer mountains and waters no longer waters. After enlightenment, mountains are once again mountains, waters once again waters. In other words, like, cool, you're enlightened, now you got to chop wood and carry water. You know, like, there's, you're not going to get, Wilson was never trying to get paid off of, he could probably have gone around saying I'm enlightened because he was, you know. But again, what is enlightenment? I mean, someone could still be enlightened and be a horrible fascist. Yasutani Roshi, who Bob learns Zazen from years later, I put it in my book, you know, it came out that he was a huge supporter of imperialist Japan during World War II. And he called them like the army, like these people that did this gross, horrible atrocities right up there with the Germans, committing war crimes to Korean people and Chinese people, like stealing all their stuff, being horrible people. Like Yasutani Roshi, before he went out to Ohio to teach Zazen, he was blessing them with the Buddha, you know? So It's an interesting thing. One can still be enlightened and still be a jerk.
I suppose. So, I was noticing a lot of the same things that you've brought up, especially in regards to, and I'm going to slaughter the name, Korzybski. Is it?
Korzybski.
Korzybski. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The, I'll just say general semantics. That I can say. Yeah. But yeah, that was one of the things that I've got this from. This was a quote from your book. Wilson then read Korzybski's declarations on how these self-deceptions are accentuated by society's continued utilization of Aristotelian logic. This false sense of oneself breeds maladjustments. We react as if our half-truths are all there is to know about a subject. Then we hypnotize ourselves into thinking that our limited descriptions accurately reflect the one true reality. To combat these tendencies, Korzybski created a new discipline, general semantics, that he thought would help people to use their nervous systems more efficiently. And so the line also that you cited from Wilson, and this leapt out at me when I initially read your book, is, wow, that's pretty much the same as Buddhism, was the language we use influences the thoughts we think much more than the thoughts we think influence the language we use. Mm-hmm. And that to me is total Buddhism. I mean, that's like one of the core ideas, is to be mindful of our thoughts. And, you know, everything follows from the thoughts.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And Wilson did get that very much from Korzybski, general semantics. Yeah. Korzybski would call it, he had a specific term, but being aware of your semantic reactions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's practicing a Bushido. It's his own form of Buddhism. You know,
yeah.
Which might not be Buddhism.
You know, it's in Buddhism, there's this concept of upaya, and upaya means skillful means. And that's kind of understood in a couple of different ways, I think. But in general, it is that as Buddhism spread and it began to engage in different cultures, Buddhist monks would utilize the religion or the traditions of these various cultures to try to teach ideas of Buddhism. And it was, you know, it's a skillful means. And another aspect of it, I always use this example, which is kind of not quite what the Buddha taught, but it's close enough, of the story of a guy that comes home and the house is on fire and his kids are in the house. And he can't get them out. You know, he's out there, you know, yelling for them and they won't come out. So what he does is he's like, hey, little Susie, I got a brand new bicycle for you, and outruns little Susie. And then he does that for each of the other kids and he's saved them all. And the question is, you know, it's, well, that's upaya. It's a skillful means. Is it a lie? Well, it wasn't necessarily the truth, but the end result was salvation, that he saved their lives. But so it seems like, you know, what he's doing is his own kind of upaya, using the skillful means that he knows to achieve a similar goal.
Yeah, that sounds, you know, very fair. I think that's, in many ways, yeah, Wilson was seeking that to enlighten his reader.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
To the nature of yourself, man. That's it.
Yeah.
Just be aware of your five senses. Start there, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and be aware of the mind. And
much so.
Yeah, and it seemed to me, I forget which one it is. I want to say it was in quantum psychology. And this is leading me to another question. But, and this seemed to be more along the lines of maybe the chaos magic, but it was like, start imagining finding a quarter. Mm-hmm. Start imagining seeing the quarter. And then lo and behold, you're going to start finding quarters everywhere. But I don't remember where I was actually going to go with that. But there was something in the sense of our thoughts and the reality that we find ourselves in. But I was curious about how Buddhism, we can throw in yoga, influenced his writing. You talked about some of the essays that he's done, but how did it manifest in some of the other writings, both the fiction and the nonfiction?
You know, perhaps with some characters, you know, utilizing Wilson, the way that his fictional writing process, writing this book about him, I really got to pop the hood and gain some insight into how he constructed his fictional work. And that was a lot of fun. And so, you know, one, for instance, is the book Schrödinger's Cat Trilogy, which he wrote, you know, after Luna was murdered, his daughter, and after his son Graham, you know, had a schizophrenic breakdown. He was very down in the dumps, but utilizing this fiction to just sort of, it was his own therapy. Like, he created characters that were like kind of inverted versions of himself, and he was working out all these emotional hard places of grief and loss and sadness. But he created an extremely funny, goofy, Kurt Vonnegut-esque, awesome novel about, you know, quantum physics and, you know, a lot of funny stuff. So through characters, he, like many writers, right, he worked out ideas and emotions. In the book, you know, Illuminatus Trilogy, you know, there's the character of the Dalai Lama, right? The Dalai Lama is the most Taoist of the Tao, and he's hanging underground, and Hagbard Chalene confronts him at the end, you know, as the world is about to fall victim to the fascist, you know, Illuminates, who are going to just kill everybody, you know, with the rising of, you know, the Yog-Sothoth and the Nazis from, you know, late Topkinkoff and whatnot. And Hagbard Chalene is confronting the Dalai Lama, like, what, you know, you have all this power, what are you going to do? And the Dalai Lama is like, man, I'm not involved, man. You know, but, you know, Bob does a really interesting thing though, right? It's like, you know, as Howard Zinn said, you cannot be neutral on a moving train. There's no, this is what the science of the 20th century brought home to very smart people, that there's no such thing as objectivity. No matter what, we're going to, you know, contaminate the experiment with our own instrument, which is ourselves. And our own instrument is infused with all these prejudices and, you know, psychological twists of our personality. And we're going to project that out onto our findings and influence our findings and then build something that is not totally syncopated with reality as it is. So Wilson does another great thing of you know, tying in these sort of Buddhist insights into science. And he finds that, you know, 20th century science coincides more with Buddhism than it does with Christianity or whatever, Judaism or Islam or whatever, only in the sense that, and I'm not saying that, only in the sense that, like, you're observing the flow of reality. You're not trying to say it's essentially this, it's essentially that. Essentially, it's non-essential because we have no self, right? And ourselves are only, you know, constructed through the relationships that we are in. I mean, this is Wilson's whole rap. He even lines that up with like existentialism and phenomenology and throwing all these words out, man, operationalism, instrumentationalism. So, you know, he's a synthesizer, you know, in many ways, but yeah, he's working with the tools that are available, I suppose. And, you know, in the 80s, leading into the 90s and quantum psychology, which I think is such an amazing book, you know, Wilson is thoroughly exploring the notion of hypnotism. He always has, but he's going even deeper into it. The idea of self-hypnotism, the work of Milton Erickson, and then other forms of hypnotism. But his take on hypnotism is that we're always hypnotized, really, because we're caught in these different trance states. And we need mindfulness and awareness, first off, to know that we're in a trance state, and then know that this trance state is transitory. And then to know that you yourself have these different constellations of motivations and attitudes within yourself. You contain multitudes and you move along in these different trance states when that's called yourself and your personality. And most likely you're unaware of it. And through things like, you know, self-introspection, therapy, philosophy, et cetera, you gain some awareness of your trance states. And then through that mindfulness, you could start breaking these trance states. And that's what Wilson is all about, like breaking a trance state, whether it's someone doing it to you, political propaganda, advertising, you know, your family, right? Or you doing it to yourself because you've internalized these things. And in order to be a free citizen, though, you know, like, you know, Rousseau said, we're noble savages, you know, we're born free and then everywhere there's chains. But for Bob, it's like, you want to get free, but to be a free citizen, there's a responsibility, you know, like Sartre said, freedom and responsibility. You want to be free today, you better learn science. That's it. Yeah. You have to learn the scientific method because you'll fall victim to, I don't know, a fascist coup that's happening right now all around us, and we got to stop this immediately, you know? Yeah. And so I find nothing but, you know, liberation in these the way that Wilson thinks. That's his main focus.
Yeah.
It's about breaking trance.
Yeah. Well, I think the trance state is Maya. It is that illusion, you know? And one of the things that I have thought of in regards to Wilson, it does come from an Indian religious tradition. It's not associated with Buddhism or what we call Hinduism, that it comes out of Jainism. And it's this idea, it's called, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this one correctly either. That's a hard one to say. It's sometimes referred to as the way of maybe. And it's this idea that in order to avoid anger and judgmentalism, you have to remain open-minded and keep in mind that any issue can be seen from many different angles, and they are all possibly true. And I've heard him talk more than once about, I think it was the Discordianism, which he framed it. It was very similar. It's like, you know, that everything's true, everything's not true, everything is true and false or false and true. It depends on how you look at it. And it gets to that idea of no objectivity, you know. And I think that's so true. If we stop thinking that these things are, that we have access to absolute truth, any one of us.
Indeed. Yeah. And then continuing that, the importance of communication, because, you know, we're all on the spaceship planet Earth together. There's not one person that can steer this thing. Right. That's totally the height of stupidity. Yeah. And for Wilson, he's known as the conspiracy theory guy, but for him, the ultimate conspiracy is the conspiracy of stupidity.
Yeah.
And looking around right now, we are headlong involved in someone else's conspiracy of stupidity, right? And we're trying to pump the brakes. And I really like that quote from Discordianism. I don't know if Wilson wrote it or if Greg Hill, you know, put words to it. But I think they call it the Shriya Saradasti or something like that. And somewhat influenced by Bertrand Russell and Buddhism. And it's the quote that, like, all affirmations are true in some sense, false in some sense, meaningless in some sense. And then Wilson would add true and false in some sense, true, false, and meaningless in some sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, which, yeah, emphasizes perspective, at least within his philosophy. That we're all, you know, there could be 10 people in the same room, but we're experiencing the room completely differently. So Wilson would start his lectures asking people, let's quickly see, what did you notice in the room? I'll write it up. What did you notice in the lobby before you came to the main hall? I'll write it up on the chalkboard. And people noticed different things. Mm. And then he would do little tricks, like put little pictures up to see if people noticed or whatever. And yeah, that was just a little thought experiment to sort of show people that, yeah, it's a huge fallacy, and it's part of our monkey minds to project to Maya, to project that we know exactly what's going on everywhere all the time. And it's a habit, you know, and it's something that I notice comes from when I'm tired or cranky or watching too much internet. Right. And then, like the old Bill Hicks, you know, bit, he's like, I'm watching CNN and it's war, death, famine, disease, war, death, famine, disease. And then I open my window, crickets, nothing but crickets, you know, he's like, so yeah, this staying constantly aware of right where you are sitting now. Right. Yeah. And because that's where that's all you have is your awareness, you know, and that's all we might leave with. And, you know, towards the end of Wilson's life, I should add too, like, I think Wilson definitely became aware of Confucianism through Ezra Pound, because Ezra Pound was very much into Confucianism and Taoism and Bob read Pound very early in his life. So one of his favorite quotes, you know, towards the end of his life was this one, when he would say, you know, the wise become Confucian in good times, Buddhist in bad times, and Taoist in old age. And yeah, Bob was definitely a Taoist in his later years. He was the most raw of his whole career, man. He just did not give an F, but like the truth bombs that he dropped were, I think, still controversial for today, right? Even more so today, right? His book, The Thing That Ate the Constitution. I mean, it's in the office right now. It's a big fat orange thing, you know, chewing up our constitution. Yeah. And then towards the very end, Wilson, this was after Arlen passed. She died in 1998. And so Bob was, you know, alone there until 2007. But he was surrounded by a sangha, you know, group of friends who really cared for him. His daughter, Christina, did a great job of sort of bringing people in to, you know, help Bob too. But there were just people who loved Bob, like Scott Appel, one of his oldest friends, who him and his wife, they helped out all the time. And it was a very sort of beautiful community he had. And towards near the end, Val and another friend, Mimi Palig, got this inkling to go visit Bob. It wasn't their day to visit him. He had friends come by like on a schedule to help out. He was sort of bedridden, very weak. And he and Val shared a love of this tradition called the death poem, which is a Zen tradition of completing a poem like right before death. And it was practiced a lot in the 13th and 14th centuries by a lot of Zen monks and samurai. So these are pretty cool last words, and they're beautiful. You can look up Zen poems. There's some beautiful things that are said and some funny things too. So Val asked Bob, you know, when was the last time he heard Arlen's poetry? Because Arlen was a poet. And he said, you know, a long time. And then Bob like kind of demanded like, Arlen, now, right? And Val and Mimi ran to the computer and printed up a bunch of Arlen's poems, and they read them to him. And then she got to the very last one. You know, this was the last poem that Arlen wrote. And it read, this is the end of the tunnel. And guess what? There is a little light. And then Bob answered and replied with his own death poem, if you will. And it was a haiku of sorts. And it was just, I love you. I love you. I love you. And, you know, that's a very touching, real human thing, you know, that how many people express that throughout the course of their lives, right?
Yeah.
I think Bob drew a lot of nice attention to like the kind of everyday heroes. They're not going to write mm-hmm. books.
Right.
They're just working. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and they love their family. They're doing the best they can. And and they have moments like that. And I think that's what this is all about. You know what I mean? These human moments, you know?
Yeah.
And Bob died sort of not long after, you know, Arlen asked there in 1959 with a befuddled look, what the hell is a sangha? And they received their answer, you know?
Yeah. I like that. That's all quite beautiful. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
yeah. That would be a really good place to end, but I do have another question or observation that I wanted to throw in. I know we're getting at the end here though. One of the things that occurs to me just listening, you know, re-listening to some of the audios that I have of him and his criticisms against the Western traditions. His criticism often is with authority. And the only real criticisms that I have heard him level against some of the Asian traditions has been against gurus. And it seemed to me that that kind of is at the heart of everything for him in many ways is, and it goes back to that anti-authoritarianism that, you know, it is the individual's responsibility for wisdom or enlightenment to lead our own lives. And that we shouldn't seek from, you know, there, we can get wisdom from gurus, but to not hand over all of our agency to them.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, Bob was a big fan of that quote. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill the Buddha.
Yeah. Right.
Murder that bastard.
Yeah. 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 And also, you know, it's because none of them are true. They're all only pointing the way. So, all right. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to add about Bob and Buddhism or his relationship to Taoism or Confucianism, how it affected his work, or have we covered most of the bases?
Well, I think I'd just like to just end it then with, you know, Bob's practice of Buddhism, Taoism, if you will, like he was not a rigid personality, right? Yeah. And you know, there's a funny story Phil Farber told me one time, I didn't put it in the book, but like Bob was picked to speak at, you know, one of these centers, right? And he ate meat. And they were all vegetarian. And he called Phil up in the middle of the night. He's like, you got to get me out of here, man. I need a cheeseburger or something, you know? Yeah. And I think there's, you know, Alan Watts was a drunk, you know, and of course, Troy Ung Trumpa was a crazy man. Like, but this is all part of it. It's a strange thing, like exactly that. Never give your agency completely over to anyone, you yeah. know, even the thoughts in your own head.
Yeah. I often complain that I sometimes feel that my imagination has been colonized by mass media and other sources, I suppose. And it's an effort to try not to do that, to reclaim my sacred land, as it were.
To do so with compassion, though. Like, that's why he loved Amitabha Buddha. Like, Amitabha said, just before you die, if you just say sincerely just once that, like, you I don't know, love Amitabha and you want to go there, you're good.
Yeah.
So, you know, one could, we could just speak more critically about that, but meaning Wilson's focus for him on himself and then other people really was like compassion, you know, although he could be a cranky jerk, but that's the whole point of this. Yeah. Like, none of us are perfect.
Yeah. I imagine that the Buddha could probably be a cranky jerk at times too.
I'd say so.
I do have one other question, and this is something that I don't know, maybe it's already been done, but as you were speaking, you mentioned a couple of his early essays, and I was just curious, has anyone ever put together any kind of volume of his essays?
Well, that would be really interesting. Yeah, he has a few omnibus books. They were put out by New Falcon, which was a collection of yes, articles and essays.
Okay.
But, you know, the Realist Archive, which is Paul Krasner's great journal, The Realist, it's now online and it's awesome thanks to this artist and archivist, Ethan Persoff. I recommend people to check it out, The Realist. It's really cool. I thought it would be, it would be really great. Like, all of Wilson's Realist articles could be put out in a little book.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I have all these articles. I could, you know, but I think that's the job for someone else.
Oh, yeah. I was just kind of curious. I've got several of the fiction and nonfiction. I don't know if I have a copy of The Thing That Ate the Constitution. I did read it, and now I think I want to read it again. I think it's very pertinent. Okay. Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for coming back. I enjoyed this conversation, and it's just amazing. Oh, I'll just let that pass. Never mind. But anyway, I enjoyed the conversation and getting to know Wilson even better. I think that, like you've mentioned, he's sort of the everyman that I think gives voice to some really profound things, and I'd like to see him be better recognized. I think in our first conversation, you said he was like the most amazing philosopher that you've never heard of.
Right.
That's how you kind of identified him. But hopefully more and more people will start hearing about him again.
Oh, I hope so, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, my book is the first start in that, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you have, you know, I always ask, and I asked you when we spoke last, and it hasn't been that long, but just as a reminder, what are you working on next?
Yeah, I think there's a few things still with the book that I'm putting together. I don't really want to speak on it yet because it's not ready yet. But yeah, I think for the next, you know, number of months, it's really still pushing this book. I'd like to get it into bookstores. I'd like to put together a tour for the book. And so just working on a number of things for that at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'd like to just say too, there's going to be a Spanish version of the book that's going to be published in the summertime.
Okay, so, right on.
Yeah, so that's going to be fun.
Okay. Well, again, what I'll do is I'll put the link for your book on your, I think it's on your website, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do that, put that in the show notes in the video description. I still have to get our episode out at the time that we're speaking on this one, but it's coming up soon, coming up soon. And I have seen you pop up on some other podcasts. So I know you were on, that you talked to Miguel Connor and I Am Byte.
Yeah, that was great.
I just saw that. So I wanted to listen to that. But again, thank you so much for your time and the work you're doing. And just one more time, I'm going to make another plug for your book. I absolutely loved the book. It was a great read. And I even think I told you at the last time we spoke, when I got to the end of it, I kind of teared up a little bit because you made me feel like Bob was my friend and his humanity and his compassion came through very loud and clear.
Oh, man. Yeah. Thank you for that, Nick. I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And that's a wrap on episode 193 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience.
As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe, and it's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I put a lot of time and effort into each episode. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship and, honestly, having some funds to come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and necessary subscriptions and other costs would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.